Well, I'm delighted to see you all here this morning. For those of you who are new to CSIS, I'm Tasey Schaefer. I'm director of the South Asia program here. As both of our distinguished visitors know, there have been many times in Washington when it was difficult to get a room full of people to talk about Sri Lanka, no matter how distinguished the visitors we had. This is clearly not one of those times. We've all watched with fascination, with concern, with hope, and occasionally with great worry, developments in Sri Lanka over the past couple of decades. I was ambassador there in the early 1990s. This moment of great opportunity, which took place when the military part of the last 25 years of internal conflict in Sri Lanka were wrapped up with the military defeat of the LTTE. I think it was widely recognized at that time that the challenge was going to be to turn this into peace, to turn victory into peace. And that, as I'm sure we all understand, is much easier to say than to do. Our two visitors this morning have been working on peace issues from their various institutional perspectives for many years, and certainly were doing so during my time in Colombo. And they are fresh from Sri Lanka and will give us some perspectives from on the ground. I know that there are a lot of there's a lot of interest in the room, otherwise you wouldn't be here, and there are perhaps other perspectives in the room as well. We will leave plenty of time for questions, and I'm delighted to be able to bring these two people to speak to you, speak to the Washington audience. Let me also acknowledge the presence of the Sri Lankan Deputy Chief of Mission, Ambassador Vijayaratne, and his colleagues, and the former Sri Lankan Ambassador to the United States, Ernest Correa. I don't see his successor, Mr. Subhasinghe, here, but he was hoping to come, and one of my successors, Sean Donnelly. So without further ado, let me, have you two decided on a batting order? I think you just either won or lost, and I'll leave you to decide which. Jahan Pereira, who when I first knew him was a journalist just returned from a year at Harvard, but who has been more of an activist stroke think tank person in the intervening years.
Thank you, Ambassador. Since Mrs. Schaefer reminded me of how we first met, she invited me to go, once she invited me to go and see the very controversial at that time American-U.S. project in a place called Iranavila, where the Voice of America relay station was being set up. And I was representing civil society, and civil society groups were agitating against that radio station. But after I went and saw the place and spoke to people in the area, I got a more nuanced view of what was happening. And so I guess the same would apply even here. There was a time I used to say that when I used to make presentations on Sri Lanka, I used to say that at that time the war had not ended, that because the war was still continuing, that there was no agreed interpretation of what the conflict was, and that would have to await the end of the war. But now, once again, although the war has ended, there is still no agreed interpretation as to what the war was about and what the continuing situation in the country is about. So I guess, as Ambassador Schaefer said, there are many views here, and this view that I'm expressing is also one such view which can be contested. In my view, the dominant feature in Sri Lanka at this time is what I would say the continuing legacy of the war. As we all know, that war that took place lasted a period of about 30 years. It involved a mobilization of our society, our multi-ethnic society, in different directions. There were human rights violations. There was terror. There was counter-terror. And there was a real mobilization of ethnic nationalism, especially in the last phase of the war, which ended just about 3 or 4 months ago. Now, there are at least three areas in which the legacy of war is visible even to this day. The first is the problem of the IDPs, 300,000 of them, confined to welfare centers, what government calls welfare centers, what others have called much worse. The government has given three reasons for keeping these people in those centers. The first, and all three relate to security concerns that stem from the war. The first is the need to demine the areas where the people once lived. The second is the constant discovery of arms that have been buried by the LTT and which need to be located and taken away. And third, that among these 300,000 people are LTT cadre, maybe hundreds, maybe thousands of them. And therefore, that this population needs to be screened. So there are two ways of looking at this. One is the security perspective, which the government is utilizing, saying that we cannot take a risk to allow these people out at this time, because among them are hundreds, if not thousands, of LTTE. And this argument has resonance with the majority population, with the ethnic majority, the Sinhalese population, who also see it through the lens of security and say, well, this is a war that went on for 30 years. It is true that a group of people are now being confined, but what to do? On the other hand, those who view it from a humanitarian perspective are horrified by what's happening, that an entire population of 300,000 people from all walks of life, educated people, government officials, well-to-do people, poor people, women, children, are being confined in this manner, not allowed to get out, living in very, very difficult circumstances, even though the government is trying very hard to improve those circumstances. And they will also focus on the violation of the rule of law, because these people are being confined to those camps with no Sri Lankan law really backing such a confinement. Another area in which the legacy of the war continues is the checkpoints. Everywhere there are checkpoints in the country. In Colombo, we thought that they would be taken away, but they are a constant reminder to us that the war is still not really over, that there is the possibility of terrorism, violence. Now, to the majority Sinhalese, this is an irritation, true, but it's a relatively minor irritation. And compared to the prospects of bombs going off again, most Sinhalese would acquiesce and say, this is a necessary feature. The war has ended only 3-4 months ago, so these checkpoints are okay. So it does not diminish the electoral support or popularity of the government, the fact that there are these checkpoints, that suddenly the roads are closed, that we had to stop and produce our identity cards. But to Tamils, the checkpoints represent something much more fearful, because it shows them that they are a target of suspicion. And as a result, they are vulnerable. I know this because when I travel with my Tamil colleagues and our vehicle is stopped and they are asked to show their IDs, there is both a sense of, a certain sense of anger in them that they are being, that the security forces will look, scrutinize their identity cards more thoroughly than that of the Sinhalese, and also a sense of fear that any soldier at any checkpoint can keep them, can detain them, can ask them questions, sense of vulnerability. And this sense of vulnerability in the face of armed soldiers and the high security presence in Colombo, while it does not affect the Sinhalese, it affects the Tamils very much. And also, it suggests to those who are what I call the dissenting sections of our society that they too are vulnerable, because especially in the last 3 years, there were so many abductions, disappearances of those people who were deemed to be in opposition to the government often, assaults on media, that dissenting sections of society seeing the armed presence in the country are also intimidated. The third area in which the legacy of the war continues is with regard to the political solution. The weakened thrust towards a political solution after the war. During the course of the war, the government had to mobilize Sinhala nationalism. It had to mobilize it because the costs of war were very high, and society had to pay for that. And by mobilizing nationalism, the government retained the support of the people. Now, after the war has ended, the argument invariably comes up that the sacrifices made to regain control over the central government, control over the whole of the country, should not be surrendered by the stroke of a pen. And I think the government is deferential to this powerful opinion that is voiced by those who, during the war, campaigned among the people and supported the war effort. Now they are making the argument that no devolution, because what was achieved at such cost, reunifying the country through the military, must not be surrendered by once again giving away power from the center. Now, although this is it's a bleak assessment that I'm making, the continuing legacy of the war, there are also some mitigating factors. Recently, elections were held local government elections were held. And just prior to those elections, the government suddenly withdrew the restrictions on fishing that had been there for many years and declared an open seas policy for the north, for the northern fishermen. Now, this was seen as an effort on the part of the government to woo the northern electorate. In addition, some of the internally displaced persons whose homes were in the Jaffna district, which is, of course, always generally under government control in the last several years, they were allowed to go back to their homes. So in this moderation of government policy, in order to win votes for the government's continued survival, one sees the ability of the government to be flexible. The election results, however, showed that, I think the election results came as a surprise to the government and to many Sinhalese who thought that after the defeat of the LTTE, that the Tamil people would actually support the government on the basis that now the LTTE, the scourge of the LTTE has been taken away from them, people will be grateful to the government. There was this thinking. And so it came as a great surprise when the election results showed that Tamil nationalism was actually not really quelled, because in one town, Vavuniya, the Tamil National Alliance, which had been identified as an LTT proxy, did the best. Despite people being a very controlled and sort of fearful environment for people to express such opinions. And even in the Jaffna election, the TNA did very well compared to the other parties. So in recognition of the fact that the Tamil vote is not turning towards the government is aware now that they have to do more to win Tamil votes. At this time, maybe the government does not need Tamil votes, because the Sinhala voting population seems to be solidly behind the government, largely on account of the sense of gratitude that this government actually won the war, which other governments failed to do. But in the longer term, although this is a short-term thing, in the longer term, it is very likely that the Sinhala vote will once again split on the two-party lines it has traditionally over the last 50 years. And then the government will need all the minority votes that it can get in order to stay in power. A sign that the government is sensitive to this is seen by the fact that the government has started negotiating with the Tamil National Alliance, which is the party that it once rejected having any dealings with as being an LTT proxy party. Another mitigating factor is the international pressure on the government and the need for the government to regain legitimacy with the international community. I think that although the government has been very critical of Western countries, I don't think this translates into popular support for that type of position. Because most people in Sri Lanka, whether Sinhalese or Tamils or Muslims, we know that it has been the Western countries that have provided aid to our country over the last 50, 60 years. It is Western tourists who come to our tourist hotels and whom our people interact with. So the effort to mobilize any sort of anti-Western sentiment is not likely to evoke a really popular response from the people. There is also among the people the feeling that the economic opportunities that the West offers are being jeopardized by the anti-Western rhetoric that is now in play. And as a result, there is internal pressure, I believe, on the government to also moderate its approach towards the Western countries. Now, in this situation, what can the international community do? I think we have to recognize that the present Sri Lankan reality is one in which the government, having won the war and believing in its rightness and in the correctness of its policies, is going to keep a certain emphasis on the security and military aspects and reliance on Sinhala nationalism. That is, I think, a reality at the present time. A government thinking that gives priority to security concerns over other concerns, such as humanitarian or human rights. And secondly, the reliance on Sinhala nationalism to take it through the forthcoming elections, which are due within the next several months, both the general elections and very likely the presidential elections. The implications of this to me are that some of the things that we would like to see as civil society or human rights activists is not going to happen. Like, for instance, I think it is very unlikely that all the IDPs will be allowed to go back to their homes, because the government is very fixed in the idea that among the IDPs are LTTE. So I think, on the other hand, the government is also under a lot of pressure because of the very bad conditions in the camps, the prospect of monsoon drains coming in and flooding the camps again. So the government is under pressure, but it is unlikely that the government will allow all the IDPs to leave at this time. Also, it is very unlikely that the government will take any positive measures to enhance the devolution of power to the Tamil areas, though the government probably, in all likelihood, will try to set up a provincial government for the north, but it will be not with any additional powers. It will be like the present arrangements with regard to devolution of power in the rest of the country, which is not very, very much. The international community in these circumstances, what I think the international community should do ought to do is to support the government in the positive things it is trying to do, whether it be resettling of some of the IDPs. The international community ought to give the fullest support to the government to resettle those IDPs in the best possible way and to compensate them for all that they have lost. Secondly, the international community should also support the government in those areas where the government is trying to find non-devolutionary solutions to the ethnic conflict, such as increasing the proportion of Tamils in the central government, in the government bureaucracy, in the police, enhancing language rights for all people. That is something that can be supported. And thirdly, I would like to see the international community also supporting civil society more than it is supporting us at this time, because those sections of civil society that dissent from the position the government takes or try to take an independent position, it's very hard for them to raise resources from within Sri Lanka. The current climate and our tradition will not permit it at this time. Businesses would not like to be associated with the organizations that take critical or independent stances. So in this circumstance, it is important that the international community should support civil society. And I'm very pleased and grateful that I have had this opportunity to come and make this type of presentation here in the United States. Because at this time in Sri Lanka, people from civil society who are taking critical stances are marginalized. We do not have access to those who have decision-making power. We are marginalized. We are referred to in derogatory terms in the medias, in the government-controlled media. And but at the same time, we still have had, my organization has had the freedom to express itself, but without the support of the established system. So any support that we can get from our friends abroad is very much appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jahan. And now we will turn the floor.
Thank you, Ambassador Schaefer, and indeed let me also express my thanks and appreciation for the opportunity to talk about the prospects for peace and reconciliation and unity in Sri Lanka. I think it's probably fair to say that at the present moment we in Sri Lanka are in what I would call a post-war situation, and that the challenge is to move from post-war to post-conflict. And in the movement towards post-conflict, an overarching objective must be to ensure that whatever is done does not reproduce the causes of conflict that plagued our country for the last three decades. In terms of objectives, I would put peace, reconciliation, and national unity as having overarching priority. And I think currently in the Sri Lankan context the sort of empirical reference points for all of this are, of course, the appalling situation that the internally displaced persons are placed in. And to remember that this is the single largest concentration of Sri Lankan Tamils in Sri Lanka at the present moment. Held under no law, and I quote the Supreme Court here, there is no legal basis for holding them. My organization and I have petitioned the Supreme Court that these are citizens of Sri Lanka who enjoy all the fundamental rights of all Sri Lankan citizens and that they should be allowed their freedom of movement. So this is key, the situation of the internally displaced persons. In addition to that is the question of a political settlement of what has been defined and articulated in the highest echelons of the Sri Lankan government as being essentially a political problem, which cannot be solved by military means alone, but which does require a political settlement as well. And I think there is a third dimension, indeed the most sensitive and controversial of them, and that is with regard to the culture of impunity. The High Commissioner for Human Rights is on record on more than one occasion of saying that in the Sri Lankan conflict, there were acts that were committed by both sides which could be tantamount to war crimes and crimes against humanity. The question that I pose in this context, given the high level of disappearances, extrajudicial killings, the shrinking space for civil society and dissent, the number of journalists who've gone into exile, the palpable self-censorship of the media, etc. The question I pose is in terms of, can there be reconciliation without accountability? And can there really be national unity without reconciliation? I think these are questions, however tough, uncomfortable they might be, that we as a country do have to face if we are to move forward and realize our full potential. Let me take the first one, which is, in a sense, the kind of litmus test, if you like, of everything else. It's the most urgent and the most pressing, and that is the situation of the IDPs, the internally displaced persons. As some of you may well know, it is about 2 weeks ago we had strong rains, and a sector, or a zone, as they are called, in the IDP camp, the largest camp, in a place called Manik Farm, outside the town of Vaunia, was flooded. Appalling conditions were compounded. People who were displaced were displaced within the area of displacement as well. A whole series of problems with regard to food, shelter, sanitation, health, all were compounded by this. This is a foretaste of what could happen when the monsoonal rains will come, and they surely will. What are the contingency plans, if any? Does anyone know them? It is very clear that 300,000 people contained in this way makes basic management of the camps extremely difficult. There is overcrowding. It is on record from humanitarian agencies themselves that 0.2 spaces which can contain X amount are now containing twice that number of persons. We are told that the over 65s have been released. Some pregnant mothers have been released. 10,000 have been identified as being LTTAs or LTT supporters, sympathizers. Child soldiers have been moved to rehabilitation camps. But the vast bulk of people remain. The argument, as Jehan pointed out, that is being made for the prolonged detention is the argument that everyone has to be screened and that they cannot be returned because the areas of their habitation are mined. Now, just a couple of points with regard to that. We know that in the course of the war, the army and the population moved from west to east. I am not aware, and I stand to be corrected, if during that movement, large number of casualties came about because they stepped on mines. Secondly, surely it must be the case that some areas are mined, others are not, and others are not so much mined. And the question, therefore, that one asks is why there cannot be a plan for return which prioritizes the areas that are not mined or least mined, and we ensure the restoration of public services to those areas and allow these people to return. Nevertheless, it is also quite clear, and if we do look at what happened in the East, it has to be voluntary return. These are people who have friends and relations who are perfectly happy to take them in. They don't have to go back to where they came from. It is their freedom of movement which needs to be prioritized in terms of restoring to them dignity and the basic rights of a Sri Lankan citizen. So with regard to internally displaced persons, there are immediate problems of crisis proportions because of the foretaste of what happened when it rained 2 weeks ago. But there is a longer-term question. And here, it may well be the case that these fears, these concerns are misplaced. But in the immediate aftermath of what one side, at least, would call an ethnic conflict, there are concerns about as to whether these people will be allowed to return to the areas that they came from, or as to whether there will be population relocation with its impact for the demographic composition of the districts and the provinces. We do know that the plan is to increase the strength of the Sri Lankan army. Where are they going to be stationed? Most likely, the vast bulk of them in the north and east, in cantonments. There is every likelihood that over a period of time there will be intermingling with the population, permanent settlements will be created, and the profile, the demographic profile of those areas could change. Now, these are concerns which have to be addressed. These are fears that have to be allayed. And they're not coming from being plucked out of the air or being put forward by the remnants of a defeated LTTE. These are concerns which have a direct bearing on the prospects for national unity and reconciliation in Sri Lanka, and they cannot be brushed aside. So with regard to the IDPs, I would like to see, for one, a plan for settlement, freedom of movement given to them, and a plan for resettlement, voluntary return, prioritizing those areas where they can return to, with benchmarks for demonstrable progress with regard to return and resettlement. In February, at the end of February, the government of Sri Lanka gave the assurance to John Holmes, the Chief Emergency Relief Coordinator of the United Nations, that 80% would be returned within a period of 6 months, effectively by the end of this year. We now hear that that was not a target, but an aspiration, that it's not 80%, that that it's 60%, and it may well be 40%. We need to know what exactly is happening with regard to this, because it is tremendously important. The weight of numbers, the enormity of the problem, all of that, personally, I will not accept as a mitigating factor, because this was known. The government of Sri Lanka very rightly urged the people to get out of the clutches of the LTTE, to cease being used as human shields, and come to safety and succor in government territory. What numbers were they thinking of at that point? Did this come as a huge surprise in that respect? Surely not. And in any event, we are now talking 3 months after the defeat. Screening of 300,000 people on a daily basis, is that feasible? Is that possible? When would that kind of process be completed? Is it not conceivable that if people are put into cramped circumstances, under horrendous conditions, those who are not militant may become militant because of their present circumstances rather than their past sentiments? So this is a problem that really does need to be tackled in a pragmatic and transparent fashion, because within it lies clear confidence-building measures which have a direct impact on unity and reconciliation. The second area is the area with regard to a political settlement. For the last 2.5 years, I think it is, the government has an all-party representatives committee which is looking at the question of a political settlement of this conflict. It is yet to provide its final conclusions, but the debate has gone on about a political settlement outside of it. The expectation has always been that the existing constitutional dispensation was insufficient to address the problem of a resolution of this conflict. And part of the existing constitutional dispensation, as you all know, is the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, which came on the heels of the Indo-Sri Lanka Accord in 1987, setting up a scheme of provincial devolution, provincial councils throughout the country. It has therefore been part of the Constitution for the last 20-odd years, and it is now to be applied to the North and the East as well. The debate has always been framed in terms of, you know, is it going to be 13th Amendment plus? And what is that plus going to be? The skeptics have said, no, it's not going to be 13th Amendment plus. It is probably going to be 13th Amendment minus. And there are two key features of the provincial council system that have yet to be implemented anywhere in the country. They relate to land powers and to police powers. Now, I think, I don't know whether it was deliberate, but it's interesting that the debate in Sri Lanka on this issue coalesces around the 13th Amendment, because it's a false debate. The 13th Amendment is part of the constitution of the country. There is no debate about it. It's part of the constitution of the country. The issue is as to whether it is sufficient to deal with the problem at hand, and if not, how much further beyond it one is willing to go to get a new constitutional agreement settlement. We also have, in the meantime, an instructive example of the 13th Amendment in action in the Eastern Province. Liberated from the clutches of the LTTE in 2006, a provincial council set up thereafter, elected provincial council set up thereafter. And let's look for a moment at how this is actually operating in the East. There has been open internecine warfare between the chief minister, a former child soldier, and his previous leader, Colonel Karuna, who is now a non-cabinet minister and vice president of the Sri Lanka Freedom Party, the ruling party, the chief party in the ruling alliance. But leaving that aside, let's look at the actual operation of it. It so happens to be the case that only a week ago, the chief minister and his ministers have written to the president asking for the governor of the province to be removed as being the chief obstacle to the operation of devolution in the eastern province. That the work of the elected council is being stymied in any number of ways by the working of the governor, who is the representative of the president. What seems to be happening is that the provincial council is a hapless bystander in a development process which is carried on from the center by the presidential secretariat. Devolution, provincial governance becomes farcical and empty in this type of situation, nothing beyond a kind of window dressing. Interestingly, whilst we do not have an elected provincial council in the north, what we do have is a development plan for the north called the Northern Spring, in English, the translation, which again is being run from the presidential secretariat with a task force that until very recently was a pan-Sinhala task force with one Muslim. Then in response to pressure, two Tamil civil servants were put on the task force. Mr. Douglas Devananda, who has been a cabinet minister in all Sri Lankan governments for the last 13 years, bar two, is not a co-chair of that task force either. What this seems to suggest, therefore, is a failure to acknowledge Tamil sensitivities and basic aspirations in terms of the destiny and the future of those areas in which they live. And this is very unfortunate, I think, in terms of the overarching requirements that I identified earlier as being peace, reconciliation, and national unity. Jehan referred to the elections in Jaffna, the Jaffna municipal elections, which the ruling alliance won. Mr. Douglas Devananda was not allowed, in effect, to run on his own party symbol. He ran as a candidate of the ruling alliance. And if one looks at the votes, one realizes that even though the UPFA won, the TNA won more votes because the UPFA was able to get the votes of Muslim IDPs and put it ahead. I happened to be in Jaffna, and my organization monitored the election. Of 100,000 people who are on the electoral registry in Jaffna, physically present, are only 60,000. Of that 60,000, only about half voted. Less than half, in fact. 60% of those who were present and able to vote did not vote. No political party, including the TNA, canvassed the people to boycott the elections. They decided that they were not going to vote. We did an opinion poll survey as well of the Jaffna municipality. And what they told us was two things. Elections are not our priority at this point. There are any number of other things that we can do. Do they really expect us to go and vote when every one of us has a friend or a relation in the IDP camps in Wavnia? And thirdly, some of them made the point. Why is it that a Tamil political party cannot stand on its own, but has to ask for votes on the basis of the symbol of the ruling coalition? So there is a huge democratic deficit there for all sides and all shades of opinion. 60% of that population did not agree with anything that any of the political parties were saying or asking them to do, and took their own decision not to take part in that election. And then I move to the third sort of empirical reference point, and that is the culture of impunity. The question of, can we have reconciliation without accountability? This is highly sensitive, very controversial, but I think one has to face it and one has to deal with it. The crimes, the atrocities of the LTT are well known. The LTT had to pay for it in terms of being prescribed by the international community. But there are serious allegations against the Sri Lankan security forces, which do not suggest that the entirety of the security forces of Sri Lanka are guilty of human rights violations, certainly not. But what needs to be addressed is the simple point that there have been violations, there have been disappearances, there have been extrajudicial killings, and quite frankly, not a damn thing has been done about them. And when you have a culture of impunity, it encourages and nurtures further human rights violations. It does not deter. Outside of the theater of war, if one looks at the human rights atrocities, you will find that they happen in broad daylight, in front of hundreds of witnesses. Those who do it know that everyone who sees it are too scared to come forward, and secondly, that in any event, they will not be punished. We need to address this. There was, in 2006, a commission of inquiry set up by the government of Sri Lanka to deal with 16 egregious cases of human rights abuses. There was an international independent commission of eminent persons attached to it that was called the IIGEP. They left in frustration in March 2008. That commission, we know, we are told, has handed in its report to the president of Sri Lanka. On one particular case, one particularly egregious case, the massacre of 17 aid workers belonging to Action Contre la Faim, the French humanitarian agency. On that particular case, we know that sections of this report, which are supposed to be with the president, have been selectively leaked to the media. We also do know that the military have gone to the families of these 17 and got them to sign two documents, two letters, both in the English language, one to the president, requesting him to intercede on their behalf to get better compensation, and the second one to the Attorney General, endorsing perpetually the findings of this commission, exonerating any security force complicity in the massacre. Then we also have the situation of the doctors as well. Now, as to why there cannot be serious and sincere judicial processes that deal with the culture of impunity is something that really seriously needs to be addressed. Can we move forward? Is it going to be the case that in the Tamil diaspora, as well as in the Tamil community of internally displaced, that like 1983 is seared on the collective psyche as one horrendous event and milestone, that if 2009 is also not looked at and the truth established to the extent that it can be, will it then not also serve as some other kind of milestone and reproduce the causes of conflict in terms of sustaining anger, frustration, bitterness. The moral arguments aside, and there are plenty, the moral arguments aside, politically, is it not self-defeating to brush this aside and refuse to look at it? So in conclusion, I want to say to you that we are in Sri Lanka, in my opinion, at a very historic juncture. There are tremendous opportunities that present themselves. And indeed, there are some very serious challenges. We from civil society have to fight to maintain the little space that we have to say what we want. I myself, as some of you may know, have just received a death threat on the grounds of purportedly misinforming the European Union about human rights in Sri Lanka and the GSP Plus concession. But progressively, what is happening is that any articulation of alternatives, articulation of dissent, is being cumulatively silenced. We are going willy-nilly into some kind of authoritarianism. And the key casualty is going to be our democracy. Sometimes our politicians talk about wanting to be a Malaysia, a Singapore, etc., and one wants them to stop and think about the cost that might have in terms of our democracy. But at the same time, I sometimes wonder, wanting to be a Malaysia, if you go in this way, might also risk ending up a Burma. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for a very sobering set of presentations. I particularly appreciate the extent to which both of you tried to acknowledge the complexity of the problem and the multiplicity of offensive and horrible situations that the Sri Lankan government and society are trying to deal with. I would like to start off the question period, actually not really the question period, by inviting Susan Hayward from USIP, which is the co-sponsor of this program, and indeed, if the truth were known, they got there first and we were asked to provide the space. She would like to make a comment or ask a question, and then I will ask the Sri Lankan embassy if it would like to comment a question. Let me say in general, though, that I will ask that all of the questioners whom I haven't specifically identified by name and handle identify themselves, and however difficult this may be in a highly charged situation, try to be brief because we want to give others an opportunity.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Shane. Hold it on. And to Uttara and the others who helped with the logistics of all of this, thank you very much. And thank you to Jihan and to Sarah for your presentations. It's a complex time in Sri Lanka, and as they both said, there are many opportunities here to support a sustainable peace. But as we all know from World Bank statistics and other places, the post-war situations are very delicate situations and can very easily devolve into a resurgence of conflict if steps are not taken carefully to support reconciliation and peace. And so I'm grateful to those who are continuing to work for peace and reconciliation in this vulnerable and difficult time. And I'm glad that we're having this forum here today. I think this is a very important foreign policy issue that doesn't always get a lot of play in this town, the Sri Lankan issue. So thank you very much. I will throw out one question for both of you, which you both acknowledge that there are security concerns that are the priority of the government right now, understandably so. And I wonder if you have suggestions for how those security concerns can be addressed by the government in a way that at best does not harm reconciliation efforts, but at worst does not harm reconciliation efforts, but at best can further reconciliation. How can we balance the security concerns with the need for reconciliation?
I think the challenge with regard to the security question is letting the IDPs go and the argument being made that every one of them has to be screened to a level of satisfaction. I don't think that the kind of screening process that one is talking about can be one that is bounded in time. You can't, I mean, you could screen a person today and tomorrow or day after, that person's political sentiments and opinion might be very different relating to the circumstances that they are placed in. So I think what needs to be done is that their basic rights need to be upheld and protected, they be allowed their freedom of movement, and that by involving them once again in the community and building trust and confidence that way, that that would be a much better guarantee of security and preventing a resurgence of the LTTE, if that is the main objective, than keeping them within a camp. The overstatement, in my opinion, of the security concern is self-defeating.
Yeah. Well, I think there needs to be a paradigm shift. Now, for instance, these IDPs, I think, are being seen by the government as being potential terrorists or potential oppressors of the people. But they should be seen as victims. If you see them as victims, then your whole approach to them changes. And my mind also goes to, you know, the ceasefire of 2002. Of course, it had been very much discredited. But how there was a paradigm shift with that new government that came, which enabled it to lift all the security barriers and then proceed on a path which was intended to keep the peace process intact. So I think the whole logic has to change. If the paradigm doesn't change, then I think if the government continues to see these people as a security threat and see the Tamils as a security threat to the country, then what's happening now follows. And all that we can hope for is that that the margin, things are improved here and there, but it's really not going to bring reconciliation. Our society, Sri Lankan society, not just the government, but our civil society, our people have to start viewing this problem differently. And if they do only, then the other things will follow, which will bring us to reconciliation.
Thank you. Ambassador Vee.
Thank you, Ambassador Teresita Safer, for giving me this opportunity to come in. Thank you, Ambassador Safer, for giving me this opportunity to comment on the views of some issues on Sri Lanka made by our distinguished friends of Sri Lanka, Dr. Saravanamuthu and Mr. Jayan Perera. Let me start by stating that the priority of the government of Sri Lanka is to expeditiously return displaced to their homes and to restore their livelihoods. The government is engaged in attending the needs of the 240,000 civilians while attempting to create the conditions for their return to their homes through extensive demining efforts. To date, over 40,000 IDPs have been released from the centers. I have circulated a handout with the breakdown of resettlement. Let us not forget that the government of Sri Lanka defeated one of the most ruthless terrorist organizations in the world. According to FBI, a mere 3.5 months ago, the LTT did not pose simply a civil threat, but a global one. since the defeat of the LTT former cadres and rebel leaders have confessed that the LTT were on the brink of purchasing nuclear weapons, according to confessions by LTT financiers. The terrorist organization had plans of selling this weaponry to other global terror outfits. The government of Sri Lanka was able to rescue civilians from the grips of this terrorist organization and the safety of these civilians, who are now IDPs, is still the priority of the government. This process requires ensuring that the areas of return must be safe, free of mines and other exploded ordnance, which could cause immeasurable harm if not cleared. As the oldest non-Western democracy in the world, the government of Sri Lanka fully understands that this process of resettlement, reconstructions, development, and national reconciliation should result in a society and a nation in which everyone is able to enjoy the full gamut of rights that are enshrined in the fundamental rights listed in the Sri Lankan Constitution. The needs of the displaced are substantial. Along with the United Nations, many countries, including the United States, India, Norway, have provided humanitarian support and assistance with demining efforts. Furthermore, Sri Lankans of all different ethnicities have come forward to assist those who were displaced. The government of Sri Lanka is confident that together with the civil society and with the support of international friends, we will ensure that all displaced will realize the social, political, and economic development on which the government has embarked. A full list of NGOs that are working in these centers is being circulated. In less than 4 months, more than 40,000 IDPs were resettled. Furthermore, significant progress has been made pertaining to the conditions of the centers themselves. Centers are no longer under military control. The Ministry of Resettlement and Disaster Relief Services, working very closely with the United Nations, now control the centers. People in these centers have 3 meals a day and access to medical facilities. The centers have schools, phone services, churches, and banking facilities to relatives. Relatives may send civilians' money. According to the UN World Food Programme country director, Mr. Khan, food supplies have never been affected by access restrictions. While there have been some unexpected challenges, for example, there were floods in the northern province. I think this two friends mentioned about the floods, how the people have been affected. During the flooding, the government worked closely with the disaster management centers, risk management program, assisted by the UNDP and UNHCR to immediately relocate certain families and promptly develop drainage system. The government realizes that key to reconciliation lies in the prompt resettlement of IDPs and redevelopment of the northern province. President Mahinda Rajapaksa announced an ambitious goal of returning the displaced civilians to their homes within 180 days. The people of Sri Lanka have seen over 25 years of war. With the help of international community, the government of Sri Lanka can demonstrate to all Sri Lankans, particularly the Tamil minority, the vast potential of our peaceful nation. With regard to this political solution, I would like to say that all party representative committee, a body composed of representatives from all parties, in Sri Lanka are currently nearing the end of their deliberation, are scheduled to present its proposal to President Mahinda Rajapaksa. It is believed that the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, which was introduced with the 1987 Indulanka Peace Accord, will be the basis of the proposal, possibly with measures that go beyond the 13th Amendment. It is important to note that this is the first time since independence that all political parties in Sri Lanka have presented ideas in one forum. And since May, just 3 months ago, without the presence of the LTT, even Tamil moderate parties who were once suppressed by the LTT are free to voice their opinion. We are pleased to note that the democratic system is already making way in Sri Lanka, which was first illustrated by the Eastern Provincial Council election in 2007. And earlier this month, at the local election in Jaffna and Vavuniya, which gave an opportunity for the Sri Lankan citizens in those areas to cast their vote after decades. These initial steps towards restoring democracy, we believe, are making a way for hope for a democratic and peaceful future for our nation. I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. Let me now open the floor for questions, and if you can put your hand up high, then I will try to catch them as they go up. Yes, sir. I'm going to let the speakers respond, but I think one of the premises of your question at this point has to be re-examined. I'm not sure who you mean by both parties, but you're not dealing with two parties to the conflict. You're dealing with the whole Sri Lankan political system at this point.
Well, I'm very sorry that you have heard nothing new and that you don't have anything to report on, perhaps because a lot of the causes, the factors relating to the causes of conflict, sustaining conflict, etc., remain and have to be addressed. Now, I can tell you what I think ought to be done, but that's neither here nor there in the sense that it is something that has to be led by the government of Sri Lanka and the political parties and the opposition and whatever. But very clearly, I don't think one is going to be able to move towards any kind of peace and reconciliation without a satisfactory addressing of the IDP situation in terms of some kind of timetable with benchmarks, with clear indicators about when this process is going to be completed, and involving those people in whatever development is being planned for the areas that they live in. I mean, I think if it is going to be very much a Colombo-directed post-conflict process, then it's going to be shutting out people who need to be included and made to feel that they are indeed citizens of Sri Lanka. And I would still argue for effective action with regard to the culture of impunity, which can be done through the judicial system within Sri Lanka. There is no reason why we need to go beyond that. But what I would like to see in that respect is implementation of the constitution of the country, specifically in this respect, the 17th Amendment to the Constitution that sets up independent commissions for the police, for the media, for the judiciary, human rights, etc., so that there will be a feeling amongst all people that, yes, it is a national commission, but it is also an independent and impartial one.
Thank you. My name is Robert Shulham from the Asian Development Bank. I'm the office in charge for our office here in North America. I'd just like to get the panelists' views on the longer-term reconstruction effort, because from our experience in various post-conflict or conflict-affected countries, whether it's Tajikistan or Indonesia, of course this is a critical thing for the sustainable development. On ADB's part, we're planning a program of about $1 billion over the next 3 years, focused very much on the north and the east, mostly in the area of critical basic needs: water, sanitation, education, health, power, really to get to grips with the livelihoods angle that you were talking about. And this will be mostly in the form of loans, to the concessional loans to the government of Sri Lanka. I'd just like to get your opinion. Are these the right priorities which have been set for funding? How successful will this be if we go along this track?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is extremely important insofar if you go back to the tsunami, the donor, international donor community came up with guiding principles with regard to recovery. And two of the key guiding principles was conflict sensitivity and subsidiarity. And I think those two principles still apply. But the key thing, of course, is the effective implementation of these principles beyond the rhetoric.
When you say subsidiarity, you mean implementation by the lowest available tier of government?
Exactly, yeah. So that my argument for saying that is important is that capacity needs to be built up at the provincial level, and it should not always be concentrated in the center. Now, the infrastructural support that you give, of course, is something that is very badly needed. There's no questions with regard to it. But conflict sensitivity would determine that, for example, if you're building a road, where does that road run through? Does it benefit one community at the expense of another? Those are issues that have to be taken into account. But very definitely, that infrastructural support is required, and it needs to reinforce and underpin capacity also at the provincial level.
And I'd like to add that in taking the decisions, the people of that part of the country must be included, because what's happening is that the decision-making is done at the center. And Sarah also spoke about this committee for the north that was appointed, which was initially all Sinhalese, and then they brought in two Tamil public servants. So that has to be changed so that there is effective participation at the center of people from the region who are empowered to, you know, not just government servants who can't really open their mouth too much, but people who are empowered to represent the people of that part of the country.
And over here.
Try that one.
I mean, yeah, that's what we have to work towards. And there was also a question about what the roadmap is. And in my view, the roadmap is first going to be the election. First, the parliamentary and presidential elections have to probably get out of the way. Because until that happens, this government, which more than most governments is conscious of politics and the way in which to win elections, is not going to take the risks of spelling out a plan that would that could evoke any opposition from Sinhala nationalists who actually helped this government in the war. So and then thereby endanger the government's Sinhala voter base, because as we saw in the north, it appears that the Tamils and maybe the other minorities are not going to be so willing to vote for this government. So the government has to rely on its Sinhala base, which it can do at this time. But it, and so it will not want to jeopardize that Sinhala unity behind it. That will only come, that that possibility comes only after the election, where we have to hope that the pragmatism for which President Rajapaksa is known for will come into play, that he will realize that if he's going to leave behind a legacy, that he and Sri Lankans can be proud of, that there has to be a shift in the way decisions are made and this problem is addressed.
Bob Boggs?
Hi, I'm Robert Boggs from the Near East South Asia Center at National Defense University. I guess my question would perhaps most appropriately directed toward Dr. Saravanamuttu. I was interested in your comments about the 13th Amendment and the extent to which or not it might serve as a template for political devolution in the country. And this will reflect my own ignorance, I think. Has the 13th Amendment and sort of provincial government been implemented anywhere in the country? I mean, even in the Sinhalese majority areas, and if not, does anybody care? I mean, is there any pressure, political pressures, either from civil society or from the political parties, to actually give it some teeth?
Well, the 13th Amendment and the provincial council system has been in existence since 1987, after the Indo-Sri Lanka Accord. There was a Northeast Provincial Council which declared UDI in frustration and was dismissed by the central government. And so there has never been an elected council until there were elections in the East 2 years ago. In the rest of the country, it's been functioning for two decades. But there are two areas in which the original statute and legislation has not been implemented, and that is with regard to land powers and with regard to the devolution of police powers.
And the other problem is that the provincial councils have been made very weak because they are not funded very well. Their funding is very little, limited. And also many of the powers have been taken back by the center, because this is a unitary system where the center has the final word. So this has weakened the provincial councils. And in terms of the demand for autonomy, I think people at the provincial level would like those bodies to be strengthened, especially those who are elected and are in those governments. They would like those bodies to be strengthened, but the center is not willing to give it to them.
Yes.
Thank you. I'm Joanna Hurlbert with the Public International Law and Policy Group. Both of you touched on the tenuous situation and the possibility of resurgence of conflict. How long do you think the Sri Lankan government has before the IDPs and the Tamil population in general become discontent again with the progress of rebuilding the country and the situation again becomes volatile?
Well, with regard to the IDPs, I think the monsoons are a good deadline.
John?
I'd like to introduce
Professor John Richardson from American University.
Sorry, thank you. A theme that we haven't heard much about, but if you read newsletters like New Sri Lanka, it's getting a lot of emphasis, is economic and business development. We focused on political solutions, but it seems clear that it's in the interest of the government as well as the business community to promote economic resurgence. And there's been a lot of activity and discussion about that, and indeed that there would be alignment between economic self-interest and some of the issues of devolution and human rights that you have been discussing and that Ambassador Wijeratne also has strongly endorsed. The question is, to what degree can the business community, and I'm thinking in particular about lots of the young business people in their 30s and 40s who have stayed in Sri Lanka, who are committed to economic development, to reawaken Sri Lanka as the development success story as opposed to being the exemplar of civil war?
Yes, I mean, that is, of course, John, as you pointed out, an extremely important dimension. I mean, let me just give you my experience that I had in Jaffna, for example, and in Vavnia, talking to local businesses there. They were
The problem with our business community, as I see it, is that they are also going along the lines taken by the government. They also give priority to security. They are not challenging the government. So there has to be a political leadership given before I think our businesses also will act in a way which is supportive of a reconciliation process.
Aziz Hanifa with India Abroad. Jehan, you spoke about some of the mitigating factors being sort of the international pressure that can be brought to bear. I would like you and Dr. Sara to speak to the role or lack of role by India in this so-called coalition of international pressure, because during the military offensive, India took a relatively hands-off policy. And although there are investigative reports that the Indian Navy passed on critical intelligence, which were able to sort of annihilate some of the rogue LTT boats, etc., since the U.S. largely defers to India as sort of the regional power, has there been disappointment, even though India did express concern over the humanitarian situation, that India has not played the kind of role perhaps that is expected of sort of a regional power? Because there is paranoia in the U.S. that it doesn't want to do anything without sort of the concert of India.
I mean, the problem is, what can, other than urge the government to do what it, to moderate its policies or to come up with a political solution or to release the IDPs, which is what the international community is doing, which is what India also has done verbally. Other than that, I suppose, what can India do? Sri Lanka, sovereign government, a government that knows its mind, does what it wants to do. In the past, 20 years ago, India intervened militarily, sent its fighter planes over Sri Lankan territory. At this time, India does not want to do that. And also, there is the China factor that people talk about, that India is very concerned that if it pushes Sri Lanka too much or does not support Sri Lanka, that Sri Lanka will turn to China. And Chinese influence in Sri Lanka is growing.
Nihal? I'm afraid you're going to have the last question because we're running out of time.
We following up on the...
Can you identify yourself?
Okay. My name is Nihal Gunawardena from International Science and Technology Institute. Following up on this 13th Amendment, right now I think there is a test case. I wouldn't even call it a case, but I know the dispute is over some land allocations by the Eastern Council. Is it your understanding that these people were acting quite independently in good faith, or were they self-dealing? Because I remember there are about 15 parcels of land that are beachfront properties that have been sold. Now, is this some kind of a self-dealing operation, or because most of these councillors are former thugs, basically. So can you kind of tell us if we are dealing with a constitutional issue or more of a self-dealing operation?
Well, I mean, yes, there is this issue at the present moment where the governor of the Eastern Provinces, the chief minister, and his associates have been illegally selling property, beachfront property. I think, I mean, a couple of things. I mean, first, this must be set in the context of the tussle between the chief minister and the governor. The chief minister and his colleagues want the governor removed. So I think one has to see it in that context. But, you know, that is the overarching question, though. At one level, if the government's argument is that it's important to start a democratic process, and yes, it will have flaws and all of that, so by referring to Mr. Pillion and his associates as not having the requisite capacity or whatever it is to run a provincial council is neither here nor there, I suppose, because the overarching concern is to bring them into the democratic mainstream. But once you brought them in there,
right,
do not undermine them. That's what's happening. And that's the tragedy at the end of the day.
Thank you.
Before I ask you to express your full appreciation for our visitors, I'd like to close with a couple of thoughts, some of which go back to my time in Sri Lanka, and others of which are more related to what we've heard this morning. There were a few issues that I thought got somewhat short shrift. The first was the question of India, but also the question of the U.S. role. India is carrying a lot of baggage in Sri Lanka from the Indo-Lanka Accord and has therefore been rather hesitant to get too deeply involved. Because, frankly, it got burned in 1987. And I think that's part of what you're dealing with. At various times, different people in Sri Lanka have urged that India become more deeply involved in what seemed to me to be a transparent effort to stick a knife into whoever they were opposing on the Sri Lankan scene. So I don't take that altogether at face value. But India is going to remain interested in what's happening in Sri Lanka. The question of security and the business community taking a security perspective, I would suggest that all business communities in all countries start with a security perspective if they are being asked to put their money at risk. They don't want their operations blown up. This is why it's been difficult to get investment into Pakistan. This is why investment in Sri Lanka collapsed after 1983. Sri Lanka was looking like the development paragon at that time. The 1983 riots came. Third specific point has to do with the intersection between local capacity and power exercised at the local level. I'm avoiding using any political science term to describe that because several potentially could apply. When I was in Sri Lanka, and this was admittedly a long time ago, I made it a point to talk to local government people when I traveled around, and Sean may have had the same experience. I must confess to you that this was a depressing experience. You had a lot of people of immense goodwill and sincerity, and no experience running anything, who all felt that they were very much the junior partner in any conversation that included even relatively junior officials appointed from Colombo, who had both money and the ability to access power. That brings me to my final thought, which has to do with this question of constitutional change. For the past almost 30 years, any conversation about resolving the ethnic conflict in Sri Lanka has revolved around constitutional change. The proposals submitted by governments over the years, and the one I was most familiar with took place when I was there. It was when Chandrika Kumaratunga was president, but there have been others by other governments. They have all revolved around constitutional change. Would there be a further amendment giving greater standing to provincial governments? Would the F word federalism be used, not used? Would the U word remain enshrined in the Constitution, unitary state, merger, devolution, all these things? They all revolved around constitutional change, and the underlying assumption was that there was a negotiating process in which the primary actors were the Sri Lankan government and the LTTE, in which they would settle something and would then have the quite considerable challenge of selling that to enough political participants in Sri Lanka, to enough of the parliament, to be able to get that elusive two-thirds vote in parliament. With the military defeat of the LTTE, it is very clear to me that the government's thinking is not centered on constitutional change, and that insofar as it's thinking about a negotiation, it's not a two-party negotiation, it's a multi-party one, but it's also a multi-community one. And how those communities get represented is very nebulous. Nobody has been elected president of the Tamil community, nor is that likely to happen. The Tamil National Alliance, which for whatever combination of fear, despair, and hope, had made a common declaration that the LTTE represented the Tamils, that happened years ago under different circumstances. Is that still where they are as a political party? I would suggest to you that the answer to that question is going to be forged in the way the government leads and other political parties participate in the process. And so I'm not saying that you need to toss out all the thinking that took place in the past 30 years, but the sort of knee-jerk model of what needs to happen next surely needs to change. I think that's one of the messages I got from both of our speakers when Dr. Saravanamuttu said that we need to think about whether the 13th Amendment will do the job. That's a fair question, but all of the near-term action involves what you do, not how you write the Constitution. And in a way, that's harder, because if your job is to create one political system out of one that had been really fractured, you need to change all kinds of habits. But at the same time, it also means that the way you do it doesn't have to start with a two-thirds vote in a parliament where anything that goes against the fears of the Sinhala nationalists is going to be right off the bat ruled out of order, as I think Dr. Pereira wisely observed. All of these things that you mentioned, whether it's allowing provincial governments in practice to deal with the question of crown land and to have authority over the police, or whether it's dealing with the question of the internally displaced persons, or addressing the culture of impunity, these are all changes in what both individuals and institutions do, how they behave. And I think that's where the real challenge lies. And like all people who wish Sri Lanka well, I wish them determination and wisdom in this effort. Let me ask you to thank our visitors who've come a long way to share their thoughts with us. And thanks for being with us this morning.